Okay, well, welcome to Politics Galore with me, Andrew Jackson. And David is away this week, so we have back on the podcast an old friend of the podcast, Alistair Stewart.
How are you doing? How are you,
Alistair?
I'm good. Thank you for getting me back. It's good to speak.
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to ask the usual question about what's been on your mind in Scottish politics this week. I suspect I know the answer. At least part of it will be to do with the SNP leadership contest, but maybe I'm being making an assumption there. So what has been on your mind in Scottish politics?
It seems every time I come on the show, actually, there is some seismic shift in the Scottish political landscape. I was tempted to come on and try and pretend that absolutely everything is normal and everything is fine, but no, it is not. Obviously, the leadership election is on my mind. I think it's on everyone's mind. I have been fascinated by it, truth be told, and I'm sort of fixated now on the Kate Forbes thing, and I think we all know what I mean by the Kate Forbes thing. How religion is playing in this leadership contest is not quite a sentence I thought I would be saying, really, and I've reflected on that and the role of sort of belief in modern Scottish politics and the reaction to it and how that's going to bear on the outcome ultimately. A lot of people, I think a lot of pundits last week, not least of all Kate Forbes' own supporters, kind of thought she was imminently due to withdraw before the nominations closed, but she's still here. I think she's still going to be the front runner, despite a lot of big hitters now quite openly getting behind Hamza Yousaf. But Forbes is still there. And I'm fascinated by the issue surrounding her own convictions and how that could bear on Forbes administration, how it's going to have an impact on how a party that's self-professed and its progressiveness is going to react, how it's going to affect the agreement with the Green Party, how that's going to fall out. This is all assuming if she gets it. And also really what kind of tone it's going to set for the rest of the UK to react to this, with the SNP, the biggest thing that they've had going for them, I suppose, is a reputation for progressiveness. How is this gonna fare? So all of that's been pretty captivating, if I'm completely honest.
Well, before we talk about some of those issues in a bit more detail, we did talk about some of them last week with David, but that's not a problem. I mean, things are moving on all the time. I haven't managed to catch up with any polling in the last few days, and I'm not even sure if there's been any. I remember that the last I think it was there more than one poll? There's one poll. Anyway, the one poll that put Kate Forbes ahead, although there were a lot of don't knows in there, was of SNP voters, not of SNP members, although obviously there may have been some crossover by accident, who knows. Yeah. And so people were saying, you know, you can't take that as necessarily representative of the membership. I also saw a tweet, I honestly can't remember who it's from, saying that the demographic of the membership skews slightly differently from what people may imagine it does. There's a lot of middle-aged people and older people in the SNP who may be more conservative than you think, sort of. That was the message that was coming across. But so I haven't seen whether or not, you know, their positions in relation to one another in recently, and I wonder if you have. But just to add something to that before you answer is, I forgot that the hustings, well, no, I didn't forget the hustings were live. I didn't realise when they started, and I saw about the last third of the one on, I think, Tuesday night, was it? Mm-hmm. So I didn't, by the time I started watching it, it had probably got past any of those issues, if they were even discussed. I haven't had time to go back and watch it from the beginning, because it's 2 hours long. And I know there's another eight to go in terms of purely SNP member hustings. And I'm not sure, I haven't even checked when they are either, so maybe there's been a couple of them happening. But my point is, by that stage in the evening, she seemed to be coming across quite well. She didn't seem to have being treated in a hostile way by the audience. And I don't know whether, in fact, the audience were extremely well behaved. And so Mike Russell was a very genial host. And I suspect, you know, they've deliberately done that, because they said, you know, we're all going to get roasted by Colin Mackay. So for God's sake, let's behave ourselves under our complete control and not fall out and start having a go at each other in the way that, you know, the opposition parties and parts of the public would love to see us do. So what I took from that was, well, at the moment, from what I can see, these things aren't affecting her as badly as may have been imagined. But as I say, I didn't see the first part of the part of the event. And she was, I mean, she was very upbeat, K-pop. She was very smiley. She made a point of smiling a lot. I noticed that. And not quite in the sort of Gordon Brown, for God's sake, smile Gordon way. But obviously somebody's told her to, you know, come across as upbeat and cheerful. Or maybe she's told herself to do that. But obviously they all have teams behind them. So have you detected anything about the relative popularity in the last few days?
I think it comes back to this initial reaction that she was going to drop out immediately. And I had an issue with that from the get-go, because it, in absolute fairness to her views, which are her views tied to her religion, were not a great secret. So yeah. When she started losing backers, my question was, well, how did you not know? Because very early on, when she obviously ascended to cabinet, she did open interviews where she talked about religion, she talked about her own faith and all the rest of it, how that, you know, her voting record is there to see it's in the public domain anyway. And then all of a sudden there was this massive kerfuffle about it. Now, she's weathered that for the most part so far. The big thing that she's not overcome, I think, is that yes, there's a more confidence in her. She's not been ruled out, but there's been no answer to the question of how will the religion thing play in her policy making. Now, that's more complicated for the SNP than most parties, because the progressive aspect of them, whether it be same-sex marriage, whether it be the gender recognition reform, they're centerpiece policies. They're front and center. So it's not something that you could just kind of scrape through, I suppose, with Kate Forbes thinks one or two things. They're flagship policies, to say nothing of the relationship with the Green Party. I would say that her popularity, from what you can see online, has stabilized in that respect. Mm-hmm. For SNP supporters, members, I think, are a harder thing to gauge. I've had anecdotal conversation with friends who see her as a safe pair of hands next to Humza Yousaf and Ash Reagan. Ash, I think, is seen as something of a wild card, I suppose. Some of her comments and media performances lately have not been too hot, to be honest with you. And Humza, if you look closely at who's coming out to back him, he's the continuity candidate. That can be a good thing and a bad thing. If you want more of the same, Humza's your guy. If you want stability, Humza's your guy. If you want to endorse the Sturgeon years, Humza's your guy. It doesn't necessarily guarantee a raft of innovation. That split between continuity and innovation and a feeling of, well, we do actually want the most experienced candidate, but the most experienced candidate may alienate cabinet colleagues, may alienate progressive members of our own party, may alienate certain sections of the electorate that have come to see the SNP as the only progressive force in Scottish politics. It's a Sophie's choice, really. It's hard, to say nothing of Humza's reputation for being not the best in the departments that he's led so far. It's a really, really hard choice. So I'm not trying to dodge the question. I just think that there now more than ever, there seems to be a disconnect between an electoral winner and or a potential electoral winner and what the membership actually want. But I mean, if this was any other political party, I would say that the SNP need to do what the Conservatives and Labour have done at various points over the last 20 years, and that is seriously sit and reflect who they are, where they've been, what they want. That's harder for them because they've got one clear objective in mind, and the road to that has never been more covered in hurdles and obstacles. The condensed, truncated leadership election is not going to help that at all. So they're going to have to play pretty hard and fast with decision making on who they want to lead them without maybe doing the necessary soul searching. So it's incredibly hard to gauge at this stage who they're going to lean into.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's obviously true. And I think it is fascinating, though. I mean, the fact that in order to stand for the leadership, I think you have to get 100 nominations across 20 different areas or some branches or something like that. So there's obviously been enough support for all of them to clear that hurdle. And that suggests, I mean, it doesn't necessarily, I mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily demonstrate that they have sort of equal support within the party, because of course, you know, there may be thousands more people who support Humza in the background who didn't require to sign the nomination papers to get over the hurdle. Mm. So we don't know that. But I do think it's indicative of the fact that, you know, there are obviously people in the party who think, you know, Kate Forbes' views don't bother them. That, as you rightly say, I mean, I think, you know, the people who backed out of Kate Forbes' campaign when the proverbial hit the fan, you know, that's just sort of political opportunity. Oh, Christ, it's all going a bit pear-shaped. I don't want to be starred with this brush. I'm going to get out of here. Yeah. Even though, of course, I knew about all these things before. I just didn't think it'd blow up in my face like this. But one of the interesting things about how it has blown up in their faces, and this would apply probably before the age of social media, is it's not quite clear the extent to which the people who are getting cross about it are representative of either Scottish society or the SNP members.
Absolutely.
And I think, but they're probably very representative of people who are on social media. And I think that's, you know, we know that social media skews very, very particularly towards people from certain backgrounds, particularly Twitter, and not sort of the general public, many of whom don't, you know, are not even on Twitter, you know, or any of that kind of stuff. It's changing, of course, but nevertheless, that's still broadly speaking the case. So I think, but the corollary of that, and I think I said this maybe in the podcast last week, but I don't want to repeat myself, we'll get back to you in a minute, but is that these people exist in Scotland. You know, Scotland is not a homogenous country where everybody thinks the same. And much as you know, Hillary Clinton called Donald Trump supporters a basket of deplorables, it didn't make them go away. You know, they still exist, and Trump won the election. Now, I'm not comparing Kate Forbes to Trump. That's not what I'm doing. But what I am saying is, this is a sort of ongoing problem that I think Scotland has, and it gets on my wick, is this idea that, number one, most of us think in a certain way, which I don't think is necessarily true. But two, we damn well should. And there's a think in a particular way. Mm. And there's a school of thought that basically reviles anybody who doesn't think that way. And, you know, this happens in other parties. It's happened particularly in the Labour Party at certain points in its history. And, you know, I mean, without wishing to sound sort of histrionic, you know, it happens in the Russian Revolution, where it's like, when we get in charge, these people will melt away. And if they don't melt away, we'll melt them away ourselves, you know. I mean, at the extreme end of things, right? Now, that's obviously not going to happen in Scotland. So the idea that you can govern a country based solely on one set of principles effectively, it's for the birds. You have to try and find some accommodation here. There has to be some sort of live and let live. And David and I did discuss this before, you know, you're dealing with issues which, you know, pretty much everyone in society really has said to be on the pale. And so, for example, the example we were discussing last week was slavery. You know, nobody's seriously suggesting, you know, if Kate Forbes said, yeah, I think we should bring back slavery, then, you know, I think a goose would be gone completely. But, you know, that and it's that sort of aggressiveness around the debate that tries to drive out and silence views which are, as we discussed last week, we're within a grey area where they're not illegal, you know, they're not extreme necessarily, although some people would say they are extreme. But you can't deal with them simply by screaming at the people who hold them, right? You might want to try and change those people's minds, and certainly I can see a situation where if you are an LGBT etc. person, you may think that somebody like Kate Forbes would exert influence on policy in a way that would basically damage your life and make things very difficult for you. And I think that although she said she would she wouldn't have voted for equal marriage. Mm. I think in some interviews she didn't. She basically was pretty lukewarm about the idea of bothering to resurrect the gender recognition reform legislation, which when David and I were discussing it, we were saying that, you know, although we did identify, there are some safeguards in it, contrary to what there are, you know, there are safeguards in there to protect people getting gender recognition certificates in certain circumstances. But she could have said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will alter the bill. I will seek to alter the bill in a way which doesn't cause it to have this knock-on effect that everybody's cross about. I can legislate to overturn the decision in the Scottish court case that affected this whole debate, or I can try and do those things. I can see if I can sort that out. So we end up with a system which perhaps satisfies some of the objectors to it, but doesn't dissatisfy the people who already support it. But she hasn't gone down that route. So I can see why there is a danger. And in that, I've described it as dangerous as an issue, because although, Kate Forbes is entitled to hold the views that she holds, I'm reasonably sure that although not all of Scotland is progressive as some elements of the SNP, most Scots probably think, well, you don't really need to get married to have a kid, do you? All those kinds of things. Yeah. And I think the thing that shocked those people who were shocked about the gender recognition bill once they realised what it was all about was less the provisions to make life easier for trans people in terms of bureaucracy and so forth, and more what they perceived to be a lack of adequate safeguards. And I'm not convinced personally that some of the proposed safeguards, or rather perhaps safeguards that could be thought through more carefully, would compromise the core purposes of that bill to the extent that trans people's lives will be damaged. I think there must be a sort of third way, if you like, which could be identified. And I think that, you know, that's the tack that she might have more sensibly taken, and which I think should be taken, because at the moment, of course, the bill's stalled. So trans people are in limbo in Scotland and can't do the things that they hope they will be able to do.
No, you're absolutely correct. But I think that chimes back to what we've both sort of touched on, is that Scotland has become a very binary place, and you're either for something or you're against something. And there's a parallel that you can say, yeah, sure, no, that's pretty common in the sort of Western world at the moment with what happened with Brexit, what happened with Trump, and a sea of other examples. But, we're relatively, devolution's not that old, and yet we've descended very quickly into a pretty ugly politics, where you're for or you're against something. There's no middle ground of actual governance. What Forbes's problem is, it's, I don't think you would have seen this 20 years ago personally, but her biggest issue is now going to be how she translates her own views into actual governing of the country while giving assurance to people that she will govern on a manifesto, but how that will inform future issues which come up. It's a very old-fashioned conundrum, but you are voting for the person or voting for the candidate. Good governance generally in Scotland is not great. I personally think that that's an unfortunate legacy of the salmon and sturgeon years, that we've had such an erosion of the ability to discuss things in public without it becoming just a screaming match, that there's a real danger that this just continues into another administration. How do you grow past this? How do you get to a situation where you have a first minister who is discursive and prepared to meet and compromise on things that you know fine well that they are not a fan of or don't agree with, but are prepared to put forward a solution which is equitable to all parties and good for the country and reflects polling, reflects mandates, and so forth? It just feels that that's a leap from what we've currently had. Maybe that's the legacy of Nicola Sturgeon so far, is that she was a leader who was in post for too long, that when it got to the stage that intransigence became sort of the de facto norm of how to govern, and the ability and the willingness to discuss things properly went out the window, that's when she should have gone. So there's quite a lot of legwork to do before you get a new first minister in post. Never mind the SNP leadership election. Scotland itself needs to have a wider discussion about how you address sensitive political issues, because so far we've not done great as of late. It just descends into a screaming match with everything. That's not aspirational politics. That's an enormously depressing state of play for public discourse. And if you're looking to attract a new generation of people interested in politics, a new generation of people who would consider being local councillors, MSPs, MPs, there needs to be some more attraction. But as I say, that's not a common, it's not a problem totally bespoke to Scotland, but we should still try and do better. And again, this would have benefited from a longer leadership election to discuss some of these broader topics.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, although I do think that thinking about the in my view, that split has come about has been sort of the fire of it has been fed, that binary nature of Scottish politics, by two things. One is the rise of social media, where people have got a whiz bang new platform to scream at each other even louder, because it doesn't really feel like you're doing that. So, you know, be as horrible as you like on social media, because it doesn't really feel like, you know, somebody's in front of you, you're in front of somebody. And we know that although there are people who are happy to continue that screaming in three dimensions, actually there are many people, you know, keyboard warriors who will be very nasty online and then, you know, run a mile from any actual confrontation in real life. But, you know, there's that. But I also do think that the attitude, that the behavior and attitude of Scottish politicians has fed that. You know, I mean, there are politicians, it's probably better not to name any, but there are politicians, as I say, who characterize their opponents in ways which they may feel are justified, because in their view, their opponents are, you know, the lowest of the low. And how can anyone think these terrible things? And this happens in both directions, all directions in Scottish politics. But that has encouraged, you know, that binary nature. The fish rots from the head. You know, I think that's a common phrase there. And I think that's there. And I think that although, you know, you're right, we haven't been behaving that way. And I do think there are some issues around, you know, Nicola Sturgeon's causing polarization of debates. I mean, it's, you know, she was has happy to use relatively inflammatory language, not as much as some of the folk who are in that, I can't remember that little organization, the Scottish Resistance, is it Scottish Resistance? You know, who basically talk about hanging BBC journalists for being unionists or like
that. Charming.
But you know, not as extreme as that. But nevertheless, it was part of that debate. And I think the new leader of the SNP should try to overcome some of those issues and bring the parliament back to some of the atmosphere that surrounded it in its early days, where there was a lot more cooperation, I think. And I mean, one of the things that was interesting about Humza Yousaf's comments about the trans issue was that he said, I can't remember his exact words, but he said he thought that Isla Bryson, the trans person who was the prison hoo-ha was all about, was at it. That was his phrase. Now, that's an admission which was not made, or at least wasn't made extensively enough in the debate, that there could be people who would be at it, in the same way that there can be people at it amongst people who try and get a job in a nursery because they have an unhealthy interest in children, or people who try and get a job in the police so they can tell their, you know, criminal buddies what the cops are doing all the time, like, you know, line of duty and all that kind of thing. But, you know, there are always bad actors in every field of human life. And I think that his recognition of, if he'd have said that during the debate, it would have gone down like a cup of cold sick. And he didn't say things like that, as far as I remember, during the ongoing debate. But his recognition of that area of concern, belated recognition in that other area of concern, might indicate a willingness to be more conciliatory when it comes to other people's arguments. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have to agree with them in the end. You know, you can say, well, you know, we've heard what you say, but we think X, Y, Z. And I mean, as I say, when David and I were discussing this, we did identify a couple of safeguards in the bill. I don't remember that messaging coming out as about the safeguards as strongly as one would have thought it should, given how strongly I think it was the Conservatives, I can't remember which MSP it was, you know, were making about their amendment for preventing sex offenders getting GRCs, and that was rejected. Yeah, it could have been. But, you know, anyway, the point is, maybe that indicates that he is willing, not just on that issue, but also on other issues, to think a bit differently from the way that apparently things have been thought of before. And this, by the way, this is not an argument from me to roll back on aspects of the GIR bill. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, given it's stuck, it has to be fixed somehow. And we've seen that the approach taken so far has failed to fix things. So a different approach is necessary. Otherwise, you're just going to go around in circles doing the same thing you've always done and getting nowhere.
You're absolutely correct. And I think that, I suppose I'll come back to Forbes for a minute on that, is that some people are having a go at Forbes for having convictions and having personal beliefs, when at the same time, for a very long time, one of the more cliched of accusations against politicians is that they have none.
Yeah.
So you've got two, I suppose, problems with the legacy and the landscape as Sturgeon leaves it, is that you need more conviction-based politicians, but you also need a more consensual style of governance.
Yeah.
And we're at the end of an era with, again, an awful cliche, but it feels it. We're at the end of an era, but we've still got some awkwardly hanging policy decisions and legislation really coming down the tracks pretty fast. The gender recognition stuff is one of them. Deposit return is another one. Yeah. And then the quote-unquote de facto
independence referendum through the general election is going to be the third sort of disaster, but that's more for the SNP. All of these things are products of willpower. And that is a government that at its, that's not height necessarily, but at a stronger ebb, was prepared to push things through with, in the name of their own progressiveness and their own vision. And then their leaders sort of jump ship while they're still standing in the, they're still there and, and you know, they're unresolved, but they're massive, they're massive things, you know? And so you've got the, their legacy products of a style of decision-making, and that is, we want it done, we're going to get it done. And then all of a sudden it comes to bear and there's still questions surrounding them. That's not great politics at all, at all. So whoever takes the center seat next needs to start thinking about their actions a little bit more. And that is, if you're going to produce seismic legislation, if you're going to make seismic policy choices, then you kind of need to take everyone with you on this. Yeah. We can't have another decade or so of this style of approach to politics. It's not healthy. It's not good for anyone. And you get situated, if you're looking for a reason why, that's not some esoteric detached observation. If you're looking for a reason why, you get seismic bits of policy, like the deposit return scheme, like the gender recognition stuff, that will have widespread implications for everyone, particularly DRS, and questions still in the ether about it. That's not good.
No. It's interesting that DR, I mean, just to take a more, well, less emotive example, the National Care Service, all three candidates have said that they were willing to pause. And, well, I mean, the Scottish government already basically said, we're pausing it until after this leadership election. But they've indicated a willingness to hear the concerns. And for those who haven't kept to us, essentially, the concern is that there's no detail about how this thing will work. That's basically the issue, because the bill is so frameworky and doesn't really contain any of that kind of stuff. But, you know, that again, we've only recently been in a position where it was the National Health Care Service is happening and you know, hell mend you if you don't. So, I mean,
exactly.
Probably, to be honest, although things like the GRR are extremely important to folk who it's designed to support, the National Care Service is going to affect a lot more people than that bill. And, you know, if they introduce National Care Service, which is basically rubbish, then lots more people would notice and be affected. And it's that, and if it's the great, you know, if it's the biggest change to Scottish healthcare since the NHS, it hasn't received anything like the attention that the NHS got when it was established.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not okay. But the interesting thing about the deposit, so just as a wee aside, is that although you know, ministers have ultimate responsibility for things, etc., I am absolutely mystified how they failed to make this application under the UK internal market legislation to the UK government for some sort of exemption, because that, to be fair to Lorna Slater, that is not something a minister would have on their top list of things I know about the scheme that has to be. You know, they would rely on officials to say, by the way, minister, you know, this interacts with this legislation and we have to. So I have a bit of sympathy for it, because I do think, I can't remember which Home Secretary tried to claim she hadn't been briefed properly by officials, then turned out that she had. But in this instance, you know, who knows, maybe Lorna Slater was briefed and didn't, and missed the, you know, didn't read it properly. But that's the kind of thing officials are supposed to be taking care of, really. So I'm a bit of sympathy for that if she really wasn't briefed on it properly. But just interestingly enough, actually, when I mean, you made reference to Humza's record, and I was thinking back about that, and I thought my initial reaction was, okay, so the hate crime bill, which he piloted, hasn't been implemented. You know, the NHS is in a right old mess, and I can't remember what he did or didn't do at transport. But on the other hand, I did think, well, the thing is, there's lots of legislation that hasn't been implemented, which has nothing to do with the people who piloted it through and ran it in the sand for all sorts of other reasons. And in fact, some legislation takes a long time to implement anyway, just because of its complexity. Although I did see somebody criticising the idea that the police were now having to be told how to understand this legislation, and wondered whether that should have been done. It should have been written so nobody had to be, you know, get extensive training to understand what it meant. But nevertheless, you know, that's not a problem unique to Humza Yousaf. And although, you know, we know that John Swinney was heavily involved in negotiations around healthcare strikes, Humza Yousif wasn't not involved. So, you know, and he said in the hustings event, actually, that, you know, he had to have a difficult conversation with John Swinney about budgets. And you know, we'll never know the extent to which Humza managed to win Swinney over, or Swinney was just like, you know, don't worry, Humza, I'll take care of this. But you can't really assume that Humza Yousif had no role in that. So he could say, I am in the process of heading off healthcare strikes, which have happened in England. And that's quite, you know, a good thing. And although I think the problem with saying that you can't blame the health secretary for things that are happening in the health service, and many of them will be happening because of the COVID legacy, and any health secretary would face the same problems. If you make that argument, you then can't claim that they have any responsibility for the successes in the health service.
Because I couldn't agree more.
If it's not MGov, then it's nothing to do with them either way, you know. And they sit at a level so high above the services for which they're responsible that they have no meaningful effect on them at all. What's the point? I mean, I suppose if you're in Northern Irish, you might say, well, exactly, what is the point? We haven't had any people in our parliament for years and it hasn't made any difference to anything. But I don't know whether that's true, whether it has made an appreciable difference or not. But it's certainly the case that Northern Ireland hasn't ground to a shuddering halt as a result.
Yeah,
who knows? But I'm a bit more sympathetic to the argument that he has achieved some significant things in his time than I initially was. But, you know, I know that that's a theme. And obviously there's lots of people online who like nothing more than retweeting that picture of him falling off his scooter as some sort of visual metaphor.
No, I mean, there is a, I suppose, if I remember correctly, there is a double standard with that. I mean, that kind of sums up some of Scottish politics, and that is that picture, which became a video, which became a GIF, did the rounds. And if I remember correctly, he did tweet that something to the effect that it's not particularly nice to laugh at people. If I recall, Humza was also making the same sort of jokes about Douglas Rossi either tripped up at a football match or something. If you know, consistency. I'm not saying that they're nice things. I'm not saying you should laugh at one or the other, but be consistent with your sort of approach to these things. Don't sound like you're throwing your toys out the pram just because it happened to you. It's funny that you touch on the NHS there with Humza. I think that the NHS will be if there is a First Minister Humza, it would be such a massive liability going into the next Scottish election. I mean, really, unbelievably so. Not as big a liability perhaps as it is now for him, but everyone's got a COVID story and everyone's got an NHS story during the pandemic and now. And if you can attribute that to one man, and if the opposition party sees it correctly, it will be an incredibly personal, visceral conversation that maybe the other candidates won't have the same weakness over. That's something that's spoke to Humza Yousif, and I think you'll see a great deal of that if he is elevated.
Yeah, although I suppose that, I mean, in terms of the effect that might have, by the time of the next election, Scottish election, the Scottish COVID inquiry will have reported, or at least, well, it's planned that it will have reported by then. I think, because it's not, you know, the aspiration is to not have a, you know, 12 years of like the trams of inquiry has been going on for
a while,
you know, to try and report relatively quickly. But there will also have been another health secretary in place for about three years, I think, which means that either they will have fixed things and people will have forgotten how bad things were, despite the COVID inquiry, or they won't. And that might have the impact that you had. Although I do think the inquiry, I mean, you know, rightly or wrongly, will probably focus largely on what happened under Jean Freeman's watch.
That's a valid point.
I don't know. And the other thing about the NHS is, I mean, I think in my experience, the story of how terrible the NHS is, you know, if you know people who work in the NHS, there's always lots of anecdotes about how terrible it is. But most of the messaging comes from, I think, from those bodies who represent people who work in the NHS and maybe some patients groups. But if you don't access the NHS often, okay, there's GP thing, right? Okay, so, you know, difficulty getting a GP appointment, that's indicative of a problem. And most people of all ages pop along at the GP a couple of times a year for one thing or another. But most people aren't in regular contact with the NHS because of their health. Not, I mean, a lot of people are, of course, but most people aren't. And so you don't experience it going wrong for yourself regularly. I, for example, I'm not representative necessarily, but you know, on a purely personal level, I've had no significant problems with the NHS in recent memory, you know, during COVID or anything else. I mean, there's nothing that I've desperately needed that I haven't been able to get and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I say I'm not necessarily representative. I'm not decrying people who have been in difficult situations, not at all. But I wonder whether the NHS being a sort of an albatross around the SNP's neck will have to rely on messaging from other places as opposed to the sort of experience. If you had a graph, you know, good experience of the NHS, bad experience of the NHS, whether the bad experience graph would actually be, you know, higher than the good experience one, or whether just because of the numbers of people, because, you know, a lot of people use the NHS repeatedly, you know, the numbers of people involved, it turns out to affect less people than some folk imagine it does, and therefore won't be an albatross around its neck to the extent that it will cost in the election.
You've touched on something that's really interesting. I've always found this interesting with the NHS, is that there's sort of two tracks to the NHS and people's user experience of it that's presented as one. And if there was a poll as to how happy you are with the NHS, I would love to see the thinking behind it, because there's two real lines of experience that I've had, I mean, most people have had. That's the staff who treat you, who are by and large wonderful, caring people who are attentive and do their job in difficult circumstances and are usually there for you at a time that you're feeling most vulnerable, or feeling most vulnerable for a family member, or you're looking at the care of a family member or a close friend, whatever. And then there's the process that goes with it. Waiting times, how long you're waiting for an ambulance, all of that. There's not that much specificity with how we talk about the NHS in Scotland when it comes to that. It's that the two are lumped together, so you're either completely happy with it or you're completely dissatisfied, but usually you're thinking one of those two things. You're either thinking the staff, you're thinking about the processes. There's also the fleeting, and you touched on something really, really important there, is I'm absolutely convinced, and this is just my opinion, I'm absolutely convinced that the reason that the NHS and the reason that health secretary isn't, the reason that governments in Scotland are not held to continual daily account with it, minus the pandemic, which was a unique set of circumstances, is because most people don't want to look it in the face. It's a reminder of your own mortality. If you're going into an NHS hospital, whether it be a required or elective procedure, whatever, it's usually a negative experience. And the ability to constantly relive that in a bid to get exposure on something that didn't go right, or it's something that you feel should be amended, it's a challenge. It's incredibly tough to do that. Now, if you've been treated for anything, you kind of just want it done and dusted. You put it behind you, unless it was something gargantuan that went wrong. And part of that, the consequence of that, is it's allowed to tick on, really, in not that great shape. And I've done it there. By not great shape, I'm not referring to the staff. I'm referring to waiting times and facilities and all these things that make a massive difference to the way that staff are allowed to do their job. If we're not going to have a sustained argument about it, or if a government is not going to have a sustained, make a sustained conversation, nothing's really going to change, to be honest with you. And that's probably immensely cynical, but as a communications practitioner in me, I believe that if you're going to change something and you want to talk about changes, let me be specific about what you're changing. So when we all talk about making the NHS better, what are you talking about? What specifically do you want to see change? If it's waiting times, we need a health secretary that does not give up, that keeps talking about these things and has daily updates and makes it as militant an issue as they did during the pandemic, when it was day after day and it was hour after hour. There's some tweet, there's some press release, there's something. If this is an emergency, it needs an emergency reaction. And again, if that's a priority for a new leader, you need someone with, I suppose, the strength of character and the fixation on minor policy detail. Sorry, not minor policy detail, policy minutiae, to come in and do that. It's a tricky situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just looking at the health and care experience survey, the latest one from the Scottish Government, which doesn't ask about all aspects of the health system. It's focused largely on primary care GPs. And despite the fact satisfaction is going down in pretty much almost all areas, it's still quite Hi. So just take it. You know, you never hear the end of in the news media about I have to ring up at 8 o'clock to get a bloody GP's appointment, and if there isn't one, I have to ring back at 1:30, and then I have to ring back at 8 o'clock the next day. Easy to contact GP practice in the way that they want to. 75% of respondents had a positive response to that. So you think, okay, so that's 10% down on last time, and so that's a big drop. But on the other hand, you think, well, yeah, but it's still 75% positive. That's pretty good. If I got 75% of my exam, you know, if I had an exam, that's a, you know, today, think. Isn't it? Or at least a B. So, I mean, it's difficult sometimes to you know, separate the noise from what's actually going on.
I think that's it. I mean, I had a personal experience a couple of months ago, and that was with a member of my family. They were waiting 8 hours for an ambulance, and they were on the floor for that length of time. Yeah. Now, that was not the happiest of experiences to live through. It's even, I don't want to look back in it. Now, when the ambulance arrived and when they went into the system, when they went into hospital, everyone was absolutely wonderful. Yeah. Totally wonderful. So I can't be alone in thinking, well, who do I shout at?
Yeah.
Exactly. The ambulance arrived. The ambulance crew were magnificent. The hospital staff were attentive and considerate and totally approachable for family and did their jobs remarkably well. Who do I shout at? what is my specific grievance in this? Someone has to take responsibility for that 8 hour waiting time, but it's not the people who arrived, and it's not the people who treated this family member.
And
that's the frustration. And correctly or wrongly, sometimes health secretaries get it in the neck. But if you don't have a specific target, I suppose, if you don't have a specific person that is holding their hands up on a daily basis and has idea after idea after idea to solve a crisis, because it is called a crisis, then what are members of the public meant to do?
Yeah, exactly.
that's it. I mean, I think that experience, I think, is pretty common with the NHS. It's like what you're saying about waiting times is that GP waiting times is that, yeah, it takes me, I looked at it once, it took me 28 phone calls to get through to a secretary one. I think my cough had cured itself by the time I got through. I forgot why I was calling. All is fine. Thank you for checking me up. It's absolutely okay. You get through, you're frustrated, and then you see a GP, all is forgotten. Yeah. And the cycle repeats the next time you use. Nothing actually changes. There's no momentum there.
Well, there we go. That's a big challenge for whoever comes into the leadership position, and indeed the health secretary. We know it won't be John Swinney. I'd be fascinated. Just it's kind of out of time, but I'd just be interested. Have you got any thoughts on who from the SNP could be the next finance secretary if Kate Forbes wins?
I don't. I'm reserving judgment on that one specifically because I think it is so absolutely bespoke to the circumstances that they find themselves in. I'm segueing slightly away from that question just to say that John Swinney would have made an absolutely fantastic First Minister for the situation that I hopefully have described, and that is the need for consensus politics, consensus discussion, and a way to go forward in a way that brings in all political parties and tracks of Scottish public life. I wish him well in what he does next, but I really would like to have seen him run and become First Minister. I think that's going to be a missed opportunity for all of us.
Yeah. And I think one of the things, I'll just add something, that if you look at the current ministerial and cabinet secretary, you know, the list of them, without naming any names, because that would be imprudent, I must say that from what I know of them, and I know something of quite a lot of them just because of the work I've done over the years, it seems to me that all the potentially really good folk are women. There may be a couple of guys in there, but it's mainly women, which is good, for sort of equality in cabinet and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's an observation I did make, because there were a couple on the, I said, we just think, oh, no. anyway, that's good to do. Okay, well, we're kind of out of time. Is there anything else you want to add, Alistair, before we wrap up?
Only to say that I think we're in for a very exciting couple of weeks. Yeah. And I don't think anyone should be ruled out too much as we enter the sort of final or the only month of the SNP leadership election. It's going to be incredibly interesting. But whoever comes in is going to have, they can honour the legacy. If they want to, they can honour the legacy of what came before. But their style has to be much more considerate and consensus style politics. It is so fundamental to the country right now, whoever that may be.
Absolutely. Okay, well, on that note, we'll wrap up. Thank you very much, Alistair, for joining me this week. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next time. Cheers. Bye-bye. Cheers.